7 minutes past 10 o'clock. Good morning. I'm Kara Lawrence. Usually I'm setting you up, my dear listeners, for a phone interview in around 10 minutes and throw a piece of music on to start the hour. But my heart is filled with joy to be joined by, in person, through some plexiglass, conductor Andrew Kohler, who is one of the most prominent regional conductors we have in West Michigan, a professor at Kalamazoo College, leader of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, leader of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, and for this semester, this year at Western Michigan University, also leading the University Symphony Orchestra. There's lots to catch up on. But first of all, again, my heart is absolutely filled to the brim with seeing you here today. Thank you.
As is mine, Kara. Thank you. It feels almost surreal to be sitting in the studio again, but so wonderful. Every little step of normalcy is so welcome, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a particularly itchy time for all of us, knowing the vaccine is close and that it's happening.
Right.
I'm seeing posts from friends saying I got my first dose and things like that. And yet we still have to be so, so careful.
Yes, exactly.
It feels so silly to be catching COVID at the end of the
right,
pandemic.
Exactly. Yeah. A self goal or something like that, right? If we don't hunker down. Yeah. And that's exactly the case with all these orchestras. You know, we're at a point where at first in the fall, it was only one orchestra that was actually meeting in person. And now a second is starting to meet in person. And there's discussions about a third of my orchestras. And it's so exciting, and I think everyone is just so starved for that kind of not just musical interaction, but also, you know, there was an article recently that was making the rounds about those sort of loose social ties, you know, not the sorts of people who are necessarily your best friends that you're planning trips with or something like that, but just people you see regularly, and how we undervalue the power that has on our social and mental well-being. And it's been in just the last 2 weeks, the Philharmonia has started rehearsing again with many, many precautions in place, of course. Precautions which are weird, I will say, you know, I mean, important, of course, and yet also slightly alienating. And even so, just the fact that we get to be in a space together and hear the reverberation and get to chat, even in passing, you know, a little bit as we maybe wait for the next piece to start or something like that is such a balm.
I certainly can understand that. I've been missing the flavors of other people, because everyone has a presence.
Yes.
And you respond.
Right.
And it does keep you sane.
Yeah, it really does.
Making music together is one of those activities that does promote this positive experience plus friendship on a level that you don't really have to talk about.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's a beautiful thing, I think, about music making friendships particularly, right? Because you can be quite introverted and still enjoy the benefits of those kinds of friendships, because you don't necessarily have to be forced to talk about everything you've been doing, or, you know, that's those opportunities exist if you want to take advantage of them, if you're sort of the person who enjoys it. And if you're not, then you can just sit down to play and just feel the presence of other beings around you and soak that in. Yeah, it's really, I have to say, I knew while I was missing it that I missed it. And yet when you get a chance to get back and see some of those people again, the confirmation of just how much you missed it, it really is almost overwhelming.
Yeah, it's not something you can prepare for exactly.
Yeah, right.
You're just like, uh-oh, I'm having a moment.
Yeah.
Well, the last time we spoke was in September. You were preparing to lead this University Symphony Orchestra through its first semester of socially distanced practice. One of the strategies happened to be performing out in front of Miller Auditorium in the Miller Plaza.
Right.
How many weeks did you get in as outdoor rehearsing?
Well, as it turned out, and this is, you know, this is a rule of life, and it's definitely a rule of COVID life, but you know, you can plan and plan and plan, and then you realize that you're going to have to adapt some things anyway. And so we did rehearse outside, I think, twice, until I took a vote with the orchestra and said, what do you think? Do we just go inside? And nearly everyone was in agreement that we needed to go inside. And the reason is, it was beautiful outside, and it wasn't an issue of the coldness. You know, when we started rehearsing first in September, it was still very beautiful, and we had a quite mild fall. But it's just so desperately impractical. You know, a little wind. I mean, we're using our own stands, right, which are those flimsy wire stands.
Oh, no.
So, you know, the slightest gust, what would feel like on an ordinary day, a beautiful light breeze is suddenly cause for flying pages. We're near the fountain. People are worried about rental music flying into the water. It's extremely difficult to hear because there's no, I mean, basically the sound just dissipates out in all directions at once, right? So there's no wall that helps sort of contain it and mix the sound together. So yeah, after just a few attempts, it felt so difficult. You know, even considering that at this moment, given all the strictures in place, we can't really do the same intensity of rehearsing that I'm used to or that I would like to be doing with the orchestra. And even understanding that we're going to have to maybe set aside some of our musical goals or temper them a little bit. I mean, not that we still wouldn't have them, of course, but that we just temper those expectations. It was still just felt impossible to get any work done. So as beautiful as the idea was, as much as I wanted to stress the idea that we would be outside as much as possible, it just wasn't practical. And in the end, all the other precautions we're taking, which include limiting the amount of rehearsal time before we stop and take a break, which include, of course, wearing masks, even the wind players wearing masks. But, you know, that was a whole other thing, finding masks that can work for various instruments, you know, because some of the ones that were hastily produced by these companies that sort of had these overlapping flaps in which you can insert a mouthpiece for our woodwind and brass colleagues,
right,
are, let's just say, were rather hastily designed and again, not very practical. So figuring out, you know, how we might modify those masks slightly to make them actually work. Flutes were especially problematic. That's one of the hardest ones to make work, have a mask work. Anyway, so lots of things to figure out. But taking all those precautions, the reduced time, making sure that everyone has a mask, making sure that those instruments also play into bags, which are trapping the aerosols, either from just the keys on a woodwind instrument or certainly from the bell of a brass instrument. And of course, keeping the numbers low so that we could, we can distance properly, should theoretically mean that, you know, even in the worst case scenario, if there is someone with an illness, that they shouldn't be able to create enough of an aerosol concentration that others would get infected. And that seemed borne out by my experience last term, which was lovely. You know, that is to say that there were a few people who did fall ill during the course of the semester, but very isolated and clearly not near one another, not even rehearsing necessarily on the same days, etc. So one did feel, at least anecdotally, that yes, these measures seem to be working and that it's not spreading within the orchestra.
I'm sorry for your wonderful string section that they had to concede to the marching band that they couldn't hack the outdoors.
That's right. That's right. We were too weak to make it work.
It's
like that marching cello skit.
I assume that the marching bands actually did rehearse outside a lot.
I think they did, yeah. They did at the beginning of the year. And I know that the bands in general, even the symphonic band, or the wind ensemble at Western, definitely stayed the course a little bit more. And I think those wind instruments, you know, were initially designed with that kind of performance, at least somewhat in mind. So that's a little bit more possible. But it felt just very difficult for the orchestra to make it work.
And with the rehearsing, you were able to pull off performances.
Yes, yeah, we were. You know, we unfortunately right now, Miller Auditorium is closed. This is difficult for the orchestra in particular because the recital hall at Western is just a little bit too small for the orchestra to really fit in comfortably with distancing requirements. As such, we had to sort of stay in our rehearsal room B, which is not the most glamorous room, but perfectly functional. But we ended up just recording our final rehearsals from there, and then streaming them. And we're going to do a similar approach this term. We've learned a few things from the first go round, and I think we'll be a little bit better prepared this time. But the same basic plan is in place.
My guest here today is Andrew Kohler, and we're talking about his work with the University Symphony Orchestra here at Western Michigan University. We'll be touching on the Junior Symphony as well and the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. But while we're talking about the WMU Symphony, we have these music conversations. You know, we're not talking about logistics.
Yes. I'll tell you, I never expected to spend so much of any summer of my life thinking about aerosol dispersion patterns. I never thought that would come up in my line of work.
And we've just spent the first 15 minutes going through some of that. Let's leave it behind a little bit.
Indeed.
Your first concert that you said that came together in the rehearsal room B at Western had a lot of different pieces on it, mm-hmm. starting with a Leopold Stokowski mm-hmm. transcription. Always fun.
Yes.
Then it says here that actually you brought in a guest soloist.
Yes. Well, we have a relationship with the Stolberg. The silver medalist is historically always the one that comes to the Western Orchestra. Her name this year is Ye Young Jin, who won the silver medal at last year's competition, which was all virtual. But I mean, there's no mistaking the brilliance of her playing. And, you know, I really labored to think, how can we make this work?
She's just going to have to wait a year or something.
Well, that was one thought. That was definitely one thought. But, you know, there'll be another competition this year. There'll be another winner. And I just thought, you know, wouldn't it be, it's still going to be inspiring for all of us to hear her playing. And though I certainly recognize it feels like there's a bit of heartbreak in knowing that there's not going to be an audience there to thrill to her playing. Still, to have her with us, to hear her brilliant work, and to be able to stream that for an audience, I think can be rewarding. So I approached her about the idea. I said, well, what do you think about that? I mean, she was supposed, of course, initially to play with us in October or something of 2020, and that got pushed back. And then I said, well, let's look at February, and then that didn't look like it was going. So I finally said, well, what about this? You would come near the end of our rehearsal period for 2 days. You know, we do one day as a dress rehearsal and one day as a recording, and then we'll throw this up on the web and we'll share it with folks. And how do you feel about it? She said, okay. And then we had to choose different pieces, of course, because she had won on the Sibelius Violin Concerto, which is a wonderful piece. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to do it, but it requires a rather large orchestra. And that's one of those considerations now. We can't really have a full-size symphony orchestra. It needs to be in the chamber range. So we discussed a couple options, and she came up with these two wonderful, brilliant showpieces, which seemed to me a little bit like one of those things that violinists used to play more often and maybe shy away from because they think it's a little too showy, but I love it. I love this old school kind of virtuosity. And it's the Saint-Saëns introduction, Rondo Capriccioso. And then, sort of, it's interesting, that was written for Pablo de Sarasate, that piece. And then Pablo de Sarasate himself wrote an introduction to Tarantella, which seems, it's a shorter piece, but maybe partially modeled on that kind of idea.
What was her reaction to going through this 2-day process? Was she happy to have performed like this?
I don't know yet because it hasn't happened. She won't be here until March. She's just agreed to the idea, and
okay.
I'll get back to you on whether or not she was pleased to have done it.
Sorry, Andrew, I'm out of the loop, man. I don't know what's going
on. I think we all feel a little out of the loop.
So this concert is currently in preparation.
We are in the middle of it. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Well, good, because I haven't missed my chance.
Yeah, that's right. It will be streaming hopefully sometime in early to mid April. We'll finish recording it at the end of March, when in-person instruction at Western ends, and we'll take a little time to get it ready for streaming, and then sometime in mid to early April, folks can expect to keep an eye out for it.
The final work on the program is one that we can feature right now. I have a recording of Coleridge Taylor Perkinson's Sinfonietta No. 1, Movement 3, from the Sphinx Virtuosi, 2011, I think.
Yes. Yes, I actually heard them play this piece here at Western when they visited.
Yeah,
and that was the first time that I was alerted to this totally brilliant and dazzling work.
This is an English composer with African heritage?
Well, see, that's the interesting thing. It's not. It's an American composer. Now, I know exactly why you're saying that.
Oh, no.
This is the beautiful thing. It there is an English composer of African heritage named Samuel.
Coleridge Taylor.
Coleridge Taylor, exactly, right? And this gentleman, Coleridge Taylor Perkinson, was named after that composer by his mother, who was also a very prominent musician in New York City when he was born, I think around 1932 or something like that. So I find that an unbelievably moving gesture, you know, that this sort of an homage of one generation of Black composer to another, recognizing the richness of that heritage, naming a son after that. And sure enough, I mean, much as Samuel Coleridge Taylor was widely feted in his day as a great composer, Coleridge Taylor Perkinson, I mean, this work that you're about to hear, this is the last movement of his first Sinfonietta, which was written when he was only, I think, 22. And it's one of those 22-year-old works where you think, well, that's just not fair that you could have that level of control over your compositional craft at so tender an age. It's really, really quite brilliantly written.
Andrew, we'll have a chance to talk about it a little further, but let's give listeners a chance to hear this final movement in a live performance from the Sphinx Virtuosi here on Classical WMUK. As I mentioned, it's a live recording from the Sphinx Virtuosi, and the leader in that recording is Damon Gupton. They played the final movement of the Sinfonietta No. 1 for strings by Coleridge Taylor Perkinson, a Black American composer from the early part of the 20th century. And if you just tuned in, I'm sitting across from conductor Andrew Kohler, who is prepping the Western Michigan University Orchestra to perform the complete Sinfonietta for strings. First, my reaction is, my goodness, that sounds as... has great integrity, great economical use of material, and for a youngster, it's like kind of the opposite of what you tend to hear from a brand new composer.
There's such tautness of the use of material, and it's just, you know, rhythmically thrilling. I mean, it's really, really well crafted. You know, it's interesting. We won't have time, I know, to listen to the other movements, but. Someone pointed out, a reviewer pointed out that the first movement in a lot of ways seems like Perkinson's sort of grappling with the music of Hindemith, the second movement arguably that of Barber, and this last movement perhaps of Bartok. And yes, distantly you can hear those influences kind of floating there, and yet, like all great composers, there's that famous expression, right? They don't borrow, they steal, right? which means that they make it their own. And that's exactly what you hear happening here. that maybe there's like some kinship you can hear between those composers and these individual movements, and yet they're fully subsumed into Perkinson's own voice, which is just, again, remarkably confident for a 22-year-old.
We also happen to hear a very good performance.
This is true. This is the Sphinx Ensemble is, I mean, as their name suggests, virtuosi. These are laureates of the Sphinx competition. They're all brilliant young Black and Latino musicians, and they just play the pants off of it, don't they?
To me, it's like asking for commitment from the players, and
It's actually, I will say this particular movement. We've just started rehearsing it, and it was not a surprise to me that it's difficult. I'm starting to see more clearly the challenges in it. And one is that yes, there's a ferocity to the expression of this particular movement. And yet it's extremely precise. Like in other words, the ferocity is written into the music. It needs to be performed in a very careful, rhythmically accurate manner to have it all come across. Those are hard things to balance in a rehearsal context.
I was talking to Maestro Querti about this the other day, with everyone spread across the rehearsal space. You have to trust the conductor because the microseconds it takes for sound to reach the other side of the room, you're going to be slow on. You can't pass off your lines with other sections by listening.
Yeah. That's right. It is all a little bit more complicated when we're so far away from one another, and the sort of, especially in the string section, you're used to having somebody right next to you. You have a feeling that you're part of a mass of sound. And now everybody is sort of made to feel like they're just a sort of a soloist island, just an archipelago of soloists connected at a distance. It's a very difficult way to play.
My guest, Andrew Kohler, will lead the University Symphony Orchestra in a program that concludes with the Sinfonietta No. 1 by Coleridge Taylor Perkinson in a concert that will be available online later next month.
In April.
So the recording sessions will
happen in March, exactly. Okay. And at the end of March, and then we'll hopefully be ready to stream something in early to mid-April.
Where's my cheat sheet here? The concert also look forward to music of Bach, arranged by Stokowski, the Sarasate Showcase Introduction in Tarantella, the Arthur Honegger's Pastoral, the Summer Pastoral.
Yes, just a beautiful piece.
I shouldn't play it. We'd all kind of relax to oblivion.
That's right, dreaming of warmer days.
And a wonderful appearance by Yi Yang Jin of the introduction and Rondo Capriccioso, first played by Sarasate and written by Camille Saint-Saëns, his great friend.
That's right.
All coming up in April. There will be a further concert that you have planned, and this one's easy. Two works.
Yes, only
on
two.
The program. Why don't you share that with us?
Oh, sure. So, the way it works out, usually the University Symphony plays two different concerts, and there, of course, we would rehearse one, play one, and then start rehearsing a second one, and that doesn't all quite work out right now. So what we're doing is rehearsing two essential programs simultaneously and then kind of recording them all at the end. The one program was the one you just described, and then the other program that will also be released in the same time period in early to mid-April has on it the wonderful El Amor Brujo, the fantastic ballet by Manuel de Falla, and then also the gossamer textures of Ravel's Mother Goose Suite. The second program is all about imagination and fantasy and the orchestral resources, even when they're limited, even when it's a small
That's
orchestra.
I know these pieces. They seem huge to me.
They're not actually, there's fewer than 10 wind players in both of them. Ravel, on the other hand, does use a fair amount of percussion, but it can be, it's a lot of different colors, but it's all covered by about three people, including timpani. I have to say, I've been really impressed with De Falla's economy of orchestration, because he really only uses a timpani, no other percussion at all, except for some tubular bells at the end of the ballet, and a piano. And with that piano, he's able to conjure sort of harp-like sounds, give it a little percussive quality, give it a modern edge. I mean, it's really quite impressive because he does not, you know, it feels as if when you're listening to it, as if this would be the kind of score that would have all kinds of splashy percussion and lots of wind sound. And it is sort of there, but he really does it with a bare minimum of players.
With suggestion.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a beautiful thing. Like the Sarasate, I'm putting a little too fine of a point on it, but, you know, he tries to get us, he is himself Spanish, as is Defaya. And of the two, the Defaya sounds far more Spanish, and yet the Sarasate is the one that uses a tambourine in it, for example, right? Uh-huh. Which is that sort of, that telltale sign that's supposed to make you think, ah, this might be Spanish music.
Right.
It's utterly absent, you know? And yet you feel as if almost as if you're hearing it in his El Amor Brujo, which, by the way, means like Love the Magician. It's a story about a woman who's haunted by a ghost and who can't find new love until she shakes off this ghost.
Well, the time now about 20 minutes before 11 o'clock. And before we move on to looking at another musical organization, the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, I want to pass on to listeners that we are under a winter weather advisory starting this afternoon at 4 o'clock and continuing until 7 p.m. tomorrow. It's a snowstorm hitting us here in West Michigan. We're expecting accumulations of 3 to 5 inches, winds gusting as high as 40 miles per hour. This will, of course, impact travel and roads significantly. We'll also experience rapidly falling temperatures tonight into the teens and wind chills around zero tomorrow. So please be prepared, plan ahead, and maybe cancel some plans. Turn it into a Zoom meeting if you can. All right, Kalamazoo Philharmonia. This is an unusual group of musicians. They are both invited from the community and featuring young musicians studying at Kalamazoo College.
Yeah.
Side by side.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about that orchestra. I mean, that's one, you know, it used to be once called the Kalamazoo College and Community Orchestra, which is great.
Describes
exactly what it is. And I opted to change it to the Kalamazoo Philharmonia just because I thought Philharmonia, right? Love of music. This is the thing that really brings us all here. No student is required to be in the orchestra. And no community member obviously is either, you know, I mean, they come there out of a passion, for playing together. And it's really just a lovely town gown kind of thing, you know, and I have to say, I've come to admire more and more that aspect of it over the years, the way that students can, yeah, you know, maybe initially feel a little like, oh, this is a bit strange. This is not a student who's my stand partner or sitting next to me. You know, this person seems way older than I am.
Look at and all then, those wrinkles.
Yes. And then eventually maybe hears, you know, talks in a break and learns that this person is a doctor, perhaps a chemist, you know, any number of other interesting professions, aerospace engineer, and thinks, oh, well, that's kind of cool. Actually, maybe I have some questions. And, you know, just that yeah, this is what we're talking about all the time, right? The natural way that dialogue can kind of take place when you're just meeting people in person, right? That's so easy to take for granted, yet so essential aspect of human interaction, and it's a beautiful thing to see happening in the Philharmonia. So, it's been really lovely to be back working with them for the last 2 weeks. Of course, K College had decided against any in-person instruction in the fall, which really prohibited our ability to do any rehearsing. Naturally, last spring, like with everything that got canceled, so these are our first tentative steps back into the fold. As I described with the Western Orchestra, we're taking all the same precautions, everything based on the aerosol dispersion studies with wind instruments that were done this summer at the University of Colorado and elsewhere. And so, you know, not everybody's participating, very understandably. Some people are wanting to be a little extra cautious, but there are some who really, I think, are just so hungry for the chance to get to make music and to do it safely. And we're giving it a go. So we've got this wonderful program of smaller works, much smaller than we usually program, of course. We have to take in mind distancing requirements. The biggest piece, the one that I suppose uses the greatest number of people, but still under 30, is the Trittico Botticelliano by Respighi, which is just, really beautiful work. I mean, Respighi was so gifted in sort of reworking those, points of inspiration from the distant past.
Yeah.
In this case,
I'll translate. It's three Botticelli pictures.
That's the stuff. Yep. Exactly right. Yeah. So of Sandro Botticelli, of course, the most famous perhaps for one of the paintings that's captured in this, which is The Birth of Venus in the Uffizi in Florence.
Well, I like that. I know that one of those movements can be used around Christmas time.
Yes, you're very right, because it's the Adoration of the Magi. That's the middle movement. But they're all, in their way, just gorgeous, sumptuous, and again, like with the Defia, using a small group of instruments to create a really distinctive but beautiful sound. We have even some, there were a few players who really wanted to play, but asked to only play a string-only work. So I thought, well, I have to make sure that we have at least one string-only work on here. And so the piece that came to mind is one of those old chestnuts that gets done a lot in the string orchestra literature, and yet might not be a name that's on everybody's tongue, and that's Peter Warlock, which was a pen name. Mm-hmm. His real name was Philip Hazeltine, and he very interesting composer and such an interesting work. These are based on Renaissance dances, and it's actually a treatise of Renaissance dances that he came across, where there's this lawyer named Capriel who's asking, well, how do you dance these dances? And the author of this book, Arbeau, is teaching him how to do each dance one by one, and mentioning some of the possible themes that could be used. And then these themes, as I understand it, I have not read the original treatise, were turned into the main themes of these movements.
Tuano Arbeau, published in the 16th century.
Yes.
With music lines and also little foot patterns.
Yes, exactly. So there are all these details about, this dance is five steps, five gliding steps, and then one leap or something like that, So it's great information for, getting a better sense of how the music ought to be felt. Warlock or Hazeltine took that inspiration point, took those melodies, and then transformed them really into something else. What I think I love most about this piece is that there are many parts of it where you think, well, this is just a straight string transcription of Renaissance music. It sounds really, truly like, the sort of dance folk music that you would hear in the Renaissance. And then every once in a while, there's just a little passing dissonance that raises an eyebrow, and you think, oh, well, that sounded funny. Mm-hmm. But he keeps revealing it more and more as the movements go on. There are six of these movements, and the last movement just ends with this almost head-banging rush where you feel like, wow, the walls have been torn down. And it's totally been made clear now that there's no way that this is an actual, rediscovered Renaissance work or something like that.
I don't recall if you mentioned that Peter Warlock was working at about the same time as Respighi. It's like the Renaissance inspiration went viral right at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it was part of that larger neoclassical movement, because it was an interesting sort of reaction. It was a reaction to the 19th century, which was obsessed with its recent past, right? Looking back at Beethoven and saying, oh, what does he teach us? How do we interpret his legacy? And then to start afresh, in the 20s, say, there were all these composers who said, well, let's forget about Beethoven for a second, and all that Teutonic heaviness, but let's find inspiration still in the past, but let's just go to a more distant past, the Baroque. That's really what neoclassical is. Despite its misleading name, it's more like a neo-Baroque kind of sound, or even let's go back further to the Renaissance.
Let's take a quick musical break so we can hear at least a few of these pieces. We could start at the beginning or start in the middle.
Yeah, I think it'd be lovely to maybe hear the first movement or two, and then to skip to the last so that we can hear those walls being broken down as I described.
This is a student ensemble from the Guildhall School. It's the Guildhall String Ensemble led by Robert Salter. That's the final movement, and we heard actually four movements from the Capriole Suite by Peter Warlock. It's programmed on the Kalamazoo Philharmonia concert that will be available for all of us to stream on our tablets or computers in a matter of weeks. Andrew Kohler is the director of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, and that's one of the pieces you programmed for a reduced ensemble. And it's a classic. I'm really glad you brought it back.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of fun. And I hope everyone heard how wild it gets there in those last moments, sort of really bringing down the facade of this Renaissance dances.
Renaissance dancing was very vigorous.
That's actually very true, isn't it? Yeah.
It had to work out.
There was all those wonderful, I read this once, discussion of the Chaconne, which Bach used, you know, but really originated in the Renaissance period, and about how it would lure people to do crazy things because it was a possessed dance practically, you know. One had to be careful making those steps.
I know. And then over time, and as culture changes, we just add this veneer of respectability to
That's
everything.
That's right. Yep.
Well, we're near the end of our time here today, and as usual, I've managed our time badly. We have a little time for an update on the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah, so the Junior Symphony has been virtual all year. It's been an enormous challenge, one faced by many orchestras, to try and figure out how we can do something meaningful in the fall. We spent quite a few weeks putting together a short program of two works that we were to have played in person, had circumstances been better. And instead we recorded them separately. And it just so happens that our new operations director, Dave Kreider, has a tremendous amount of music editing and production skill in his back pocket, but that was a lucky break. We did not hire him with that skill set in mind necessarily, but it sure came in handy. Mm-hmm. And he worked just enormous hours to put together performance. We're doing that again right now in a sort of shortened period. So we're just preparing the Overture to the Barber of Seville by Rossini, which is a great classic, very challenging, but a great classic.
It's a substantial piece.
It is. It really is. And as a colleague of mine, Bill Wheeler, who plays the first bassoonist in the Kalamazoo Symphony, put it, it if it sounds like it's work, and it is work, but if it sounds like it's work, we're doing it wrong. So it has to be, we have to be, exactly. Get it to a point where we can make it sound tossed off. Anyway, we're going to do that with the aid of some music software that's going to make Dave's work a little easier, but still substantial. And then the board will meet soon and talk about what the rest of the year might hold. I personally am hoping that there will be that we can find a path to safely coming back together, because it just seems to me too heartbreaking to go a whole year. I mean, there are students in the Junior Symphony right now whom I've never met in person. They auditioned on a video, and I've only seen them on video, and I've never been in the same space with them to hear them make music. So
I think perhaps I'd like to leave listeners with the idea of zooming out on educators' response to young musicians. You're working with musicians who are from middle school as well as college and from and adulthood. And you're part of a bigger community of educators here.
Right.
I'm assuming that you haven't been totally siloed, that the communication among you all has been somewhat therapeutic and helpful at times.
That's definitely the case. I can say that, for example, John Verano, who conducts the Grand Rapids Youth Symphony, and I have been in touch about, you know, reading arcane bits of the new orders that come down from MDHHS and what they might mean for the programs and how our respective organizations are interpreting them and understanding them and what they might mean for us. And as you point out, just sharing the frustrations of the difficulties of these moments and what we lose when we're not able to be in person.
Well, look for another update with Maestro Andrew Kohler in a number of weeks, I hope. We'll be able to announce some of these online concerts and things will be looking great as spring comes along and vaccinations continue. We have to leave it there for now. The news is about to take over the programming. Thank you so much, Andrew.
What a pleasure. Great to see you, Karen.